This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. This is Part 8. Lectures entitled Faith, Love, and Hope, Part 1. Delivered on December 2nd, 1911, in Nuremberg. It's from the collection called Faith, Love, and Hope. This evening and tomorrow evening, we shall attempt a coherent study of the nature of the human being and the human connection with the esoteric foundations of the present time and the near future. From various indications I have given here, you will have grasped that today we are, to some extent, facing a new revelation, a new announcement to humankind. If we keep in mind the recent periods of human evolution, it may well be that we will best understand what is approaching if we connect it with two other important revelations. In doing so, we will be considering, it is true, only what has been revealed to humankind in times relatively near our own. These three revelations, the one now to come and the two others, may be best understood by comparing them to the early development of a child. By observing children properly, we find that when they first come into the world, they must be protected and cared for by those around them. They have no way to express what is going on within them or to formulate in thought what affects their souls. To begin with, children cannot speak or think. Everything must be done for them by those who have received them in their midst. Then they begin to speak. Those who watch attentively, this is mentioned in my book titled The Education of the Child, know that first children imitate what they hear, and that during the early days of speaking they have no understanding that can be attributed to thinking. What they say does not arise from thought. Precisely the opposite happens. They learn to think by talking, and learn gradually to apprehend in clear thought what they were previously prompted to say from the hidden depths of feeling. Thus we have three successive periods in child development. First, a period when children are unable to speak or think. Second, a period when they can speak, but not yet think. And third, a period when they become conscious of thoughts in what they say. We may compare these three stages in the child's development with what humankind has gone through, and has still to go through, since about 1500 years before the Christian era. The first revelation that we may speak of as coming to humankind during the present cycle of time is the revelation proceeding from Sinai as the Ten Commandments. Anyone going more deeply into the significance of what was revealed to humankind in these commandments will find great cause for wonder. The fact is, however, that people take these spiritual treasures so much for granted that little thought is given to them. But those who reflect upon their significance have to admit how remarkable it is that in these Ten Commandments something is given that has spread through the world as law, something that in its fundamental character still holds good today and forms the basis of the law in all countries, insofar as during the last 1,000 years the Ten Commandments have gradually been adopted by modern civilization. Something all-embracing, grand, universal, is revealed to humankind as if in these words. There is a primal being in the spiritual world whose image is here on earth, the I, capital. This being can so infuse his own power into the human I, so pour himself into it, that a person is enabled to conform to the norms, the laws, given in the Ten Commandments. The second revelation came about through the mystery of Golgotha. What can we say about this mystery? What can be said was indicated yesterday in the public lecture from Jesus to Christ. It was shown there that just as we can only understand human beings in their bodily nature as descending through the generations from the original human couple on earth, So we can only understand rightly the greatest gift coming to our I-being, which must sink more and more into our I-being during earthly existence, by tracing it back to the mystery of Golgotha. It need not concern us here that the old Hebrew tradition has a different conception from that of present-day science. If we trace back human beings' blood relationship, their bodily relation to that original human couple, Adam and Eve, who once lived on earth as the first physical personalities, the primal forebears of humankind, and if we must therefore say that the blood flowing in human veins goes back to that human pair, we can ask, where must we look for the origin of the most precious gift bestowed on our soul, that holiest, most valuable gift, which accomplishes never-ending marvels in the soul, and makes itself known to our consciousness as something higher than the ordinary I within us? For the answer, we must turn to what arose from the grave on Golgotha. What arose then lives on in every human soul that has experienced an inner awakening, just as the blood of Adam and Eve continues to live in the body of every human being. We have to see a kind of fountainhead, a primal fatherhood, in the risen Christ, the spiritual Adam who enters the souls of those who have experienced an awakening, bringing them for the first time to the fullness of their I, to what gives life to their I in the right way. Thus, just as the life of Adam's body lives on in the physical bodies of all human beings, what arose from the grave on Golgotha flows in like manner through the souls of those who find the path to it. That is the second revelation given to humankind. We are enabled to learn what happened through the mystery of Golgotha. If in the Ten Commandments human beings have received guidance from outside, this guidance may be compared to what happens to the child before it can either speak or think. What is done for the child by its environment was achieved by the old Jewish law for all humankind, which until then lacked, as it were, the power of speaking and thinking. Human beings, however, have now learned to speak, or rather have learned something that may be compared to the child's learning to speak. They have gained knowledge of the mystery of Golgotha through the Gospels. And the way they first understood the Gospels may be compared with how a child learns to speak. Through the Gospels there has come to human souls and human hearts some degree of understanding for the mystery of Golgotha, which finds its way into human feelings and perceptions, and into the soul forces arising in us, when, for example, we allow the deeply significant, intuitive scenes and pictures drawn from the Gospels by great painters to work upon us. It is the same with traditional pictures of the adoration of the child by the shepherds, or by the wise men from the east, of the flight into Egypt, and so on. All this leads back in the end to the Gospels. It has reached human understanding in such a way that humans may be said to have learned to speak, in their fashion, about the mystery of Golgotha. In this connection, we are now moving toward the third period, which may be compared with how the child learns the thought content in its own speech and can become conscious of it. We are approaching the revelation that should give us the full content, the thought content of the Gospels, all that they contain of soul and spirit. For at present people understand the Gospels no better than the child understands what it says before it can think. In the context of world history, people are meant to learn through spiritual science, to reflect upon the thoughts in the Gospels, to let the whole deep spiritual content of the Gospels work upon them for the first time. This indeed is connected with a further great event that humankind can feel approaching and will experience before the end of the 20th century. This event can be brought before our souls in somewhat the following way. If, once again, we enter the nature of the mystery of Golgotha, we realize that the elements of the Christ that rose from the grave of Golgotha have remained with the earth, so that they can directly affect every human soul, awakening the I to a higher stage of existence. We may say that through the mystery of Golgotha, Christ became the spirit of the earth, and has remained so since that time. In our day, however, a change is coming in the relation of the Christ to human beings, an important change you have come to know something about, the new revelation of the Christ to human beings. This revelation can also be characterized in another way. To do this, we must turn to what happens when human beings go through the gate of death. This is something that could not be described in books, but must now be spoken of. When human beings have passed through the gate of death, have experienced the backward survey of the previous earthly life, and have come to the point when the etheric body is laid aside, and the time has come for Kamaloka, they are first met by two figures. Usually only one is mentioned, but to complete the picture, and this is a reality for every true esotericist, we must say that before Kamaloka, the human being is confronted by two figures. What I am now telling you holds good. It is true only for people of the West, and for those who during the last 1,000 years have been connected with Western culture. These people are confronted after death by two figures. One is Moses. They know quite clearly that it is Moses who stands before them, holding out the tables of the law. In the Middle Ages, Moses, with his stern law, was spoken of. And in their souls, human beings are keenly aware of how far, in their inmost being, they have transgressed against this law. The other figure is the cherubim with the flaming sword, who pronounces judgment on these transgressions. That is an experience human beings have after death. Thus, in accordance with spiritual science, it can be said that there is a kind of settlement of the karmic account by these two figures, Moses with the stern law and the cherubim with the flaming sword. In our time, however, a change is approaching, an important change that can be described in this way. Christ is becoming Lord of Karma for all those who, after death, experience what has just been discussed. Christ is entering his judgeship. Let us look more closely into this fact. From the world conception of spiritual science, we all know that a karmic account is kept of our life, that there is a certain balancing of the deeds standing on the credit side of the account, the sensible deeds, the fine deeds, those that are good, and on the other side, the bad, ugly, lying deeds and thoughts. Now, it is important, on the one hand, that in the further course of their earthly lives, individuals should themselves adjust the balance of this karmic account. But this living out of the result of good and splendid deeds, or those that are bad, can be done in many different ways. The particular adjustment in the future life is not always determined after the same pattern. Suppose someone has done a bad action. That person must compensate for it by doing a good one. This good action, however, can be achieved in two ways, and it may require the same effort on the person's part to do good to a few people, only as to benefit a considerable number. The concern of the Christ, who in our time is becoming Lord of Karma, will be to ensure that in the future, when we have found our way to him, our karmic accounts will be balanced, inserted in the cosmic order, in a way that will benefit as many people as possible. This taking over by Christ of the judging of a person's actions is the result of his direct intervention in human destiny. This intervention is not in a physical body. It is on behalf of those human beings on earth who will increasingly acquire the capacity to perceive him. There will be people, for instance, who suddenly become aware of an urge to refrain from doing something they are doing because of a remarkable vision. They will perceive in a dreamlike way what appears to be their own action, yet they will not be able to remember having done it. There will be more and more cases of this from now on during the next 3,000 years. those who, in the course of their evolution, are not prepared for such a thing to happen, will look upon it as merely imagination run wild, or as a pathological condition of the soul. However, those who, through spiritual science, have been sufficiently prepared for the revelation being renewed for humanity in our time, this third revelation during the most recent cycle of humanity, will understand that this all points to the development of new human faculties, ones that enable human beings to see into the spiritual world. They will also realize that the image appearing to their soul is a forewarning of the karmic act that must be accomplished, either in this earthly life or in a later one, to compensate for what they have done. In other words, people will gradually achieve, through their own efforts, the faculty for perceiving in a vision the karmic adjustment, the compensating deed that must be accomplished in the future. From this fact it can be seen that in our time as well, we should say, as did John the Baptist by the Jordan, change your state of soul, for the time is coming when new faculties will awake in human beings. But this form of karmic perception will arise in such a way that here and there the figure of the etheric Christ, the actual Christ as he is living in the astral world, will be directly visible to some individual, not in the physical body, but as the newly awakened human faculties he will manifest on earth as counselor and protector of those who need advice, help, or solace in the loneliness of their lives. The time is coming when human beings, who feel depressed and miserable for one reason or another, will increasingly find the help of their fellows less important and valuable. The force of individuality, of individual life, will count for more and more, while the power of one person to work helpfully upon the soul of another, which held good in the past, will tend constantly to diminish. In its stead, the great counselor will appear in etheric form. Therefore, the best advice we can receive for the future, and this certainly applies to young people today, is to strengthen our souls and fill them with energy. In this way, as we advance into the future, whether in this incarnation or in the next, we may realize with increasing strength the newly awakened faculties that give us knowledge of the great counselor, who at the same time is becoming the judge of a person's karma. This is knowledge of Christ in his new form. For those who have already prepared here for the Christ event of the 20th century, when this event becomes widely experienced, it will make no difference whether they are in the physical body or have passed through the gate of death. Those who have passed through will still correctly understand the Christ event and have the right connection with it. This will not be the case, however, for those who have thoughtlessly passed by this third great forewarning given to humanity through spiritual science. The Christ event must be prepared for in the physical body here on earth. Those who go through the gate of death without giving even a glance into spiritual science during their present incarnation will have to wait until their next incarnation before gaining a right understanding of the Christ event. It is an actual fact that those who have never heard on the physical plane of the Christ event are unable to come to an understanding of it between death and rebirth. They too must wait until they can prepare for it upon their return to the physical plane. Therefore, when their present incarnations end at death, these people in their essential being remain unconcerned in the face of the mighty event referred to, Christ's assuming the judgeship, the possibility of his intervening in an etheric body directly from the astral world in the evolution of humankind, and is becoming visible in various places. It is characteristic of human evolution that old human attributes, not closely connected with spiritual evolution, gradually lose significance. When we consider human evolution since the Atlantean catastrophe, we can say that among the great differentiations prepared during the Atlantean age, present-day human beings have become accustomed to those of race. We can still speak in a certain sense of an old Indian race, of an old Persian race, of an Egyptian or a Greco-Latin one, and even of something in our own time corresponding to a fifth race. But the concept of race in relation to human evolution is ceasing to have a right meaning. In the sixth cultural epoch, which will follow our own, something that applied in earlier times will no longer apply. The necessity of having some spatial center to spread the culture of the epoch. The important thing is the spreading of spiritual science among people without distinction of race, nation, or family. In the sixth cultural epoch, those who have accepted spiritual science will come out of every race and will found throughout the earth a new culture, no longer based on the concept of race. That concept will have lost its significance. In short, what is important in the world of Maya, the external world of space, vanishes. We must learn to recognize this in the future course of our spiritual science movement. At the beginning, this was not understood. Therefore, when we read Alcott's title, Buddhist Catechism, which once served well, we get the impression that races continue to roll on like so many wheels. But for the coming time, such concepts are losing their significance. Everything subject to the limitations of space will lose significance. Anyone, therefore, who thoroughly understands the meaning of human evolution understands that the coming appearance of Christ during the next 3,000 years does not involve the restriction of Christ to a body limited by space, nor to a certain territory. Neither will his appearance be limited to one place at a time. His help will arrive at the same moment here, there, and everywhere. A spiritual being is not subject to the laws of space, and anyone who can be helped by Christ's direct presence is able to receive that help at one end of the earth just as well as someone at the opposite end. Only those who are unwilling to recognize humanity's progress toward spirituality and what gradually transforms all the most important events into the spiritual can declare that the being of Christ implies a limitation to the physical body. We have now described the facts concerning the third revelation, and how this revelation is already in the process of throwing new light on the Gospels. The Gospels are the language, and anthroposophy is their thought content. As language is related to a child's full consciousness, so are the Gospels related to the new revelation that comes directly from the spiritual world, related in effect to what spiritual science is to become for humankind. When we come to discern first out of the soul's unconscious depths and then ever more clearly our connection with anthroposophy, we must be aware that we have in fact a certain task to fulfill, a task of understanding. We must look upon it, in a sense, as a mark of distinction bestowed by the world spirit, a sign of grace on the part of the creative guiding spirit of the world, when today our heart urges us toward this new announcement that is added as a third revelation to those proclaimed from Sinai and from the Jordan. The task given in this new announcement is to learn to know the human being in its entire being, to perceive ever more deeply that what we are principally conscious of is sheathed in other members of the human being, which are nevertheless important for a person's life as a whole. It is necessary for our friends to learn about these matters from the most varied points of view. So I will now say a few words about the human being's inner being. You know that if we start from the actual center of its being, from the I, capital, we come next to the sheath we give the more or less abstract name of astral body. Further out, we find the so-called etheric body, and still further outside, the physical body. From the point of view of real life, we can speak about the human sheaths in another way. And today we will take directly from life what can, it is true, be learned only from esoteric insight, but can be understood through unprejudiced observation. Many people, due to their so-called scientific world conception, have become arrogant and overbearing, and say, quote, "The ages of faith are long gone. They are suited to humanity during its childhood phase, but now we are progressed to knowledge. People must have knowledge of everything today and should no longer merely believe," unquote. Now, that may all sound very good, but it is not based on genuine understanding. We must ask more than simply... We must ask more than simply whether knowledge has been gained through ordinary science during current human evolution. Other questions must be asked. Is faith itself significant for humanity? Isn't it part of a person's very nature to believe? Of course, it might be possible for some to want to dispense with faith for some reason and throw it away. People can, for a while, play fast and loose with their health without any obvious harm. When they come to view faith as merely a cherished gift to their ancestors in the past, it is the same as recklessly abusing one's health for a while, and in this way depleting the forces one possessed previously. When people view faith in that way, they are still, as far as the life forces of their soul are concerned, living on the old gift of faith, handed down to them through tradition. It is not for human beings to decide whether to lay aside faith or not. Faith is a question of life-giving forces in the soul. The important point is not whether we believe or not, but that the forces expressed in the word faith are necessary to the soul, for the soul incapable of faith becomes withered, dried up like the desert. There were once human beings who, without any knowledge of natural science, were much more clever than those today with a scientific world conception. They did not say as people imagine they would have said, "I believe that I do not know." They said, "I believe what I know for certain." Knowledge is the only foundation of faith. We should know in order to take increasing possession of the forces that are the forces of faith in the human soul. In our soul, we must have what enables us to look toward a supersensible world, what makes it possible for us to turn all our thoughts and conceptions in that direction. If we do not possess forces like those expressed in the word faith, something in us goes to waste. We wither like leaves in autumn. For a while this may not seem to matter, but then things begin to go wrong. Were human beings in reality to lose all faith, they would soon see what it means for evolution. By losing the forces of faith, they would be incapacitated for finding their way about in life. Their very existence would be undermined by fear, care, and anxiety. To put it briefly, it is only through the forces of faith that we can receive the life that should well up to invigorate the soul. This is because, imperceptible at first for ordinary consciousness, something lies in the hidden depths of our being, in which our true I is embedded. This something which immediately makes itself felt, if we fail to bring it fresh life, is the human sheath where the forces of faith are active. We may term it the faith soul, or, as I prefer, the faith body. It has hitherto been given the more abstract name of astral body. The most important forces of the astral body are those of faith. So the term astral body and the term faith body are equally justified. A second force that is also to be found in the hidden depths of a person's life is the force expressed by the word love. Love is not only something that links human beings together, it is also needed by them as individuals. When people are incapable of developing the force of love, they become dried up and withered in their inner being. We have merely to picture to ourselves those who are such great egoists that they are unable to love. Even where the case is less extreme, it is sad to see people who find it difficult to love, who pass through an incarnation without the living warmth that love alone can generate, love for something on earth at any rate. Such persons are a distressing sight as they go through the world in their dull, prosaic way. Love is a living force that stimulates something deep in our being, keeping it awake and alive, an even deeper force than faith. And just as we are cradled in a body of faith, which from another aspect can be called the astral body, so are we cradled also in a body of love, or as we call it in spiritual science, the etheric body, the body of life forces. For the chief forces working in us from the etheric body, out of the depths of our being, are those expressed in the human capacity for loving at every stage of our existence. What if people could completely empty their being of the force of love? But in fact, that is impossible for the greatest egoist, thank God. For even in egoistic striving, there is still an element of love. For example, those who are unable to love anything else can often begin, if sufficiently avaricious, by loving money, at least substituting another love for charitable love, though it arises from egoism. If there were no love at all in a human being, the enveloping structure that should be sustained by love forces would shrivel, and the person empty of love would actually perish. Such a person would in fact die physically. This withering of love's forces can also be called a withering of the etheric body's forces, for the etheric body is the same as the body of love. Thus, at the very center of a human being, we have its essential kernel, the I, surrounded by its enveloping structures, first the body of faith and then the body of love, around it. If we go farther, we come to another set of forces we all need in life. And if some people do not or cannot have them at all, that is very distinctly to be seen in their external nature. For the forces we need emphatically as life-giving forces are those of hope, of confidence in the future. As far as the physical world is concerned, people cannot take a single step in life without hope. They certainly make strange excuses sometimes, if they are unwilling to acknowledge, that human beings need to know something of what happens between death and rebirth. They say, "Why do we need to know that, when we don't know what will happen to us here from one day to another? So why are we supposed to know what takes place between death and the new birth?" But do we actually know nothing about tomorrow? We may have no knowledge of what is important for the details of our supersensible life, or, to speak more bluntly, whether or not we will be physically alive. But we do know one thing, that if we are physically alive tomorrow, there will be morning, midday, evening, just as there are today. If, as a carpenter, I make a table today, it will still be there tomorrow. If I am a shoemaker, someone will be able to put on tomorrow what I make today. And if I sow seeds, I know that next year they will come up. We know about the future just as much as we need to know. Life would be impossible in the physical world were not future events to be preceded by hope in this rhythmical way. Would anyone make a table today without being sure it would not be destroyed in the night? Would anyone sow seeds without having an idea about what would become of them? It is precisely in physical life that we need hope, for everything is upheld by hope, and without it nothing can be done. The forces of hope, therefore, are connected with our last sheath as human beings, with our physical body. What the forces of faith are for our astral body, and the love forces are for the etheric body, the forces of hope are for the physical body. Thus people who are unable to hope, who are always despondent about what they suppose the future may bring, will go through the world with this clearly visible in their physical appearance. Nothing makes for deep wrinkles, those deadening forces in the physical body, sooner than lack of hope. The inmost kernel of our being may be said to be sheathed in our faith body or astral body, in our body of love or etheric body, and in our hope body or physical body. We comprehend the true significance of our physical body only when we bear in mind that in reality it is not sustained by external physical forces of attraction and repulsion, that is, a materialistic idea, but has in it what, according to our concepts, we know as forces of hope. Our physical body is built up by hope, not by forces of attraction and repulsion. This very point can show that the new spiritual scientific revelation gives us the truth. What then does spiritual science give us? By revealing the all-embracing laws of karma and reincarnation, spiritual science gives us something that permeates us with spiritual hope, just as does our awareness on the physical plane that the sun will rise tomorrow and that seeds will eventually grow into plants. It shows, if we understand karma, that our physical body, which will perish into dust when we have gone through the gate of death, can, through the forces permeating us with hope, be rebuilt for a new life. Spiritual science fills people with the strongest forces of hope. Were this spiritual science, this new revelation for the present time, to be rejected, human beings naturally would return to earth in future all the same, for life on earth would not cease because of people's ignorance of its laws. Human beings would incarnate again, but there would be something very strange about these incarnations. Human beings would gradually become a race with bodies wrinkled and shriveled all over, earthly bodies that would finally be so crippled that people would be entirely incapacitated. To put it briefly, in future incarnations, a condition of dying away, of withering up, would assail human beings, if their consciousness, and from there the hidden depths of their being, right down into the physical body, were not given fresh life through the power of hope. This power of hope arises through the certainty of knowledge gained from the laws of karma and reincarnation. Already there is a tendency in human beings to produce withering bodies, which in the future would become increasingly rickety, even in the very bones. Marrow will be brought to the bones, forces of life to the nerves by this new revelation, whose value will not reside merely in theories, but in its life-giving forces, above all in those of hope. Faith, love, and hope constitute three stages in the essential being of humankind. They are necessary for health and for life as a whole, for without them we cannot exist. Just as work cannot be done in a dark room until light is obtained, it is equally impossible for human beings to carry on in their fourfold nature if their three sheaths are not permeated, warmed through, and strengthened by faith, love, and hope. For faith, love, and hope are the basic forces in our astral body, our etheric body, and our physical body. And from this one instance you can judge, how the new revelation makes its entry into the world, permeating the old language with thought content. Are not these three wonderful words urged upon us in the gospel revelation, these words of wisdom that ring through the ages, faith, love, hope? But little has been understood of their whole connection with human life, so little that only in certain places has their right sequence been observed. It is true that faith, love, and hope are sometimes put in this correct order, but the significance of the words is so little appreciated that we often hear faith, hope, love, which is incorrect. For you cannot say astral body, physical body, etheric body, if you would give them their right sequence. That would be putting things higgledy-piggledy, or as a child will sometimes do before it understands the thought content of what is said. It is the same with everything relating to the second revelation. It is permeated throughout with thought, and we are striven to permeate with thought our explanation of the Gospels. For what have they meant for people up to now? They have been something with which to fortify humankind, and to fill it with great and powerful perceptions, something to inspire human beings to enter the depth of heart and feeling in the mystery of Golgotha. But now consider the simple fact that people have only just begun to reflect upon the Gospels, and in doing so they have, straightway, found contradictions, which spiritual science alone can help to illuminate. Thus it is only now that they are beginning to let their souls be worked on by the thought content of what the Gospels give them in a language of the supersensible worlds. In this connection, we have pointed out what is so essential and of such consequence for our age, the new appearance of the Christ in an etheric body, for his appearance in a physical body is ruled out by the whole character of our times. Hence we have indicated that the Christ, in contradistinction, as it were, to the suffering Christ on Golgotha, is appearing now as Christ triumphant, Christ the Lord of Karma. This has been foreshadowed by those who have painted him as the Christ of the Last Judgment. Whether painted or described in words, something is represented that will come to pass at the appointed time. In truth, this begins in the 20th century and will hold good until the end of the earth. It is in our 20th century that this judgment, this ordering of karma, begins, and we have seen how infinitely important it is for our age that this revelation come to human beings, in such a way that even concepts such as faith, love, and hope can be given their true valuation for the first time. John the Baptist said, "Change your mood of soul, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." In other words, accept the human eye that no longer needs to avoid approaching the spiritual world. This is a saying that clearly points to what is in question here, that with the event of Palestine, the time came for the supersensible to pour light into the human eye. Thus the heavens are able to descend into the eye. Previously, the eye could come to human beings only by sinking into their unconscious. But those who interpret everything materialistically say that the Christ dealt with the weaknesses, errors, and prejudices of his contemporaries, that he even foretold, like the credulous people of his time, the realization of the millennium or of a great catastrophe for the earth. Neither of these events, however, occurred. There was indeed a catastrophe, but it was perceptible only to the spirit. The credulous and superstitious, who believed Christ foretold that his actual coming would be from the clouds, interpreted his meaning in a materialistic way. Today also there are people who thus interpret what is to be grasped only in spirit. And when nothing happens in a material sense, they judge the matter in just the same way as was done in the case of the millennium. How many, indeed, we find today, who, speaking almost pityingly of those events, say that Christ was influenced by the beliefs of his time, and looked for the impending approach to earth of the kingdom of heaven. That was a weakness on Christ's part, they say. And then it was seen, and remarked upon even by distinguished theologians, that the kingdom of heaven has not come down on earth. It may be that people will meet our new revelation as well in such a way that after a time, when the enhancement of human faculties is in full swing, they will say, "Well, nothing has come of all these predictions of yours," not realizing that they just cannot see what is there. Thus do events repeat themselves. Spiritual science is meant to gather together a large number of people until the fulfillment of what has been said by those with a right knowledge of how the new revelation and new supersensible facts are appearing in human evolution during this century. They will then continue their course in the same way, becoming ever more significant throughout the next 3,000 years, until weighty new facts will once more be revealed to humankind. The end of Part 8.